Okay, well, welcome back, and it's always a good sign when the coffee breaks extend in length during the course of a day like this, and it's great that we can have time together, and the chatting time is very, very important, the fellowship time on a conference like this, isn't it? So thanks for the various questions I was asked. Let me just give you 5 minutes in case there are other questions that we didn't have time to cover in the last section. We won't hang around and wait, but there may be questions that you wanted to ask and didn't feel there was time for. I wouldn't like you to think that I was 6 feet above contradiction, which is what most pulpits are, isn't it? No? Okay, I take that as total... Alex,
just one question. You're talking about how, obviously, reading what's there in terms of the genre, so reading it correct in terms of the genre as well as in terms of the immediate content. How does that work? So, you know, if someone's never read a poem before and they read a psalm, are they not equipped then to understand it in the same way? How much do you use that sort of genre of literature outside the Bible in order to interpret, say, the creation story in Genesis?
Yeah.
How do you navigate that?
Thank you very much. It's a question about, in a sense, different levels of interpretation, I think. I would say that when I said the Bible is an ocean to swim in or the kids can paddle in the shallows, it's a little bit like that. So I think if you've never read a poem before and you come to a psalm, you have no idea of how poetry works. If you read the psalm and you pray that God will give you help through it, you'll find it. There will be help given. You'll find something in the psalm that relates to you, that's true, that encourages or rebukes or whatever. But if you're going to be someone who devotes their lives to teaching other people, you're going to want to go further than that in understanding some of the below-the-surface operations in these things. You know, I mean, I can drive a car and I hugely appreciate having a car, but lift up the hood and look inside... And I'm completely sunk. I don't know how it works at all. So if you're going to buy a second-hand car, you have to do that, don't you? You lift up the hood and then, but I wouldn't have a clue what I'm looking at. And yet I can benefit from the car. So I think what we're saying is that we've, as those who are set apart to do this, we want to be the best practitioners we can be. And we want to be workmen who do not need to be ashamed, rightly handling the word of truth. And because that word of truth is given by God, but given through human agency, then, you know, to compare the Genesis narrative of creation with other creation myths from the ancient world, and to see what is the genre of creation explanation, and then to see the distinctiveness of the Genesis myth and the quality myth in technical terms, the quality of the Genesis account, then that is... I think that's quite enriching, but I wouldn't expect to take my whole congregation through that. So I think what I'm saying is you have to go to the greatest depth you can yourself, but in presenting it to others, give them the fruit of that rather than take them through the mechanics of it. Having said that, I would always have in any church I pastored a group for people who want to get deeper into the Bible. And I'd run a sort of little, like a Tim course for them, maybe one night every couple of weeks or something like that, so that the people who've really got an appetite to get into Scripture more deeply can do that. And that will involve both spiritual understanding and also intellectual understanding of the way the genre works. I think I don't see the two as opposed to one another, because God is the author of it all. And I think if we work on any of those levels, we'll enrich our own understanding. But then we've got to, you know, to feed it in ways that people can assimilate it. So Spurgeon famously said that the Bible, that Jesus said, "Feed my sheep, not feed my giraffes." And by which he meant, you know, some people put it up here, and the average sheep is never going to get it, because they don't have that opportunity, training, time to do it. So, you know, we're not to try and make the sheep into giraffes. We need to feed it in a way that communicates to them. And that's not being condescending. It's just saying God's given me the privilege of spending all my life on this, and I'm set apart to do that, to feed the flock. Okay, push on? Push on. I take one nod as agreement. Now, be warned. let's just look very quickly at analyse the text. I realise that some of us are more experienced in this than others, and if today some of the things we've said are a bit elementary, well, that's great. We're at different levels. But tomorrow we're going to look especially at the preaching side of it. I just wanted to establish some of the mechanics today in the genre side of things. And of course, the text is made up of scenes and characters and dialogue and plot. And it is important to give attention to these various aspects of it. So when I'm dealing with a narrative, one of the first things I will try and do is to divide it up into scenes. I find it helpful to say, if I was going to make a film of this, what would be the major episodes in it? And what, I'm not quite to the extent of what would be the camera angles, but the sense of, you know, where would I need to change the scene? Where would I have a different angle? And I don't make those decisions. The text makes the decisions, but I have to work with the way in which the text is put together. So the action is broken up into a sequence of events. Often one scene is between two characters. Sometimes it's one character and a group. And through it all, there is the pervasive presence of God, because it's God acting and speaking through the events. There's always the backdrop of God's promises, of his requirements, of his commands that need to be obeyed. But that helps us to break up the narrative into units. And if you do that basic work, it will give you a structure for the sermon when it comes up. See, one of the challenges in preaching narratives is not just to retell the story. We may retell parts of the story in the sermon, but we need to have a good enough handle on the story that we can see where the emphases are, what the major points are, and what those turning points are. Now, in the narrative, secondly, there'll be characters. As I said, there's very little physical description, very little visual image of the characters. Where they do occur, that obviously is purposeful. So where you get something like being told the height of Goliath, the purpose is that you realise that this is a massive giant. And the significance is there just in that little detail. But the description usually enables us to place the character in terms of their character. So we may be told something about their race or about their status or about their profession or about their relationship vis-a-vis somebody else in the story. But primarily what we're told is, what kind of person is this? We get a view of, Gideon, you know, the angel of the Lord comes to him, there he is threshing his wheat, hidden down in the wine press, so that nobody will see him, and he says, "You're a mighty man of valour." And you get this discontinuity immediately between what God sees of what he's going to do through Gideon and who Gideon is at the present moment. What kind of person are we dealing with here? Often the characterization in narratives is a contrasting one, Jacob vis-a-vis Esau, Abraham and Lot, for example, David and Saul. They're to be understood and interpreted in relation to one another. And the contrast motif is often strong in the narrative. But sometimes the narratives introduce parallel characters, Moses and Joshua, Elijah and Elisha, Samuel and David, where similar qualities are seen in successive stories or in two characters merging within a story. So we understand the character through their words, through their actions, but the mistake then is to say, now, which character do you want to identify with? Because then, you see, we start to become the arbiter of the story rather than allowing the story to dictate to us how we read it. So often you'll find that in Bible study outlines, that one of the questions will be for a group Bible study, which character in the story do you most easily identify with? That is a nonsense question, really. Doesn't get you anywhere. That's not the way that the story is put together anyway. And it's not there for me to say, oh, I rather like Jezebel or something. that's not the way to approach it. The characters are there in terms of their relationship to the God who is the overarching subject of the story. So I keep on stressing this, I know, but to me, the big line on narrative is, what is God teaching me about God here? What is God teaching me about God in this story? Now, the characters will all help me to understand that as he relates to them and they to him, or as they don't relate to him. But it's not there for me to sort of select a character and say, you know, this is me. So a friend of mine went as a curate to a church for the first time, his first curacy, and he was told by his vicar, you're in charge of going around the house groups, and I suggest you go to each of them in turn, just starting a series on Abraham. So it's September, start of the sort of church year, because it's the start of our academic year. And he turns up at the first group, and they're doing Genesis 12, and this wonderful, massive, huge covenant promise to Abraham that, as you know, dictates most of the rest of the Bible. And within 5 minutes, the group is saying, oh, God's given me a wonderful promise too. I was told this, I was told that. And it's all about us and the group. And Abraham was just a springboard forgotten after 5 minutes. And the whole thing just became a sharing, a pooling of experience. Now, I think a lot of Bible study groups do that because they perhaps don't know how to do it any better. And they're not awfully well served sometimes by the outlines that they use. But it's not the way to go, is it? Because it's just going to run into your experience. And where does that go? It runs into the sand at the end. Just a warning on that, that we need to teach people by the way we teach the narrative, how to handle the narrative. Dialogue? Well, dialogue is the major means of characterization. So the two run very closely together. Usually the dialogue is as important, if not more important, than the actual telling of the story. The heart of the story often lies in the verbal exchanges that are between the characters. So I would say do pay attention to the dialogue. The first words that the character speaks are often among the most important words. They establish who the character is. They're significant in setting the tone of this character's involvement in the story. Frequently, there's repetition of those words, or there's contradiction of them by somebody else's speech. You know, the whole business of the way the story is advanced through the dialogue. Going back to the Jonah story, chapter 1, for example, the dialogue between Jonah and the sailors advances the story. Actually, in terms of the narrative, all we're told is there was a great storm and then the storm stopped. But the story tells us why, because of the dialogue between the characters. And the detail of the dialogue is going to be important. But don't lose sight of the plot, that every story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And as we've said, there is often a turning point, which is a teaching point. The story is usually moved forward by conflict. The interest is to see how the problem will be resolved, or how the conflict will be overcome, or what the conflict will lead to. And there's usually a decisive point in the story where we see a divine intervention. Think of the commission of Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, and the divine intervention in the promise of God but God coming into the situation and saying, no, don't do that, stop, that isn't what I want you to do, Abraham. I wanted to be assured of your obedience, but the resolution is the divine intervention at that point in the story. And it's not until you get to Hebrews that you learn why Abraham could keep going, because he believed that God could raise Isaac even from the dead. So plot is important. Keep the plot running. Don't just pick out an ingredient of it, because the whole plot is the structure of the narrative. And by working out how things develop, we can help people to identify with it and take them through. I think when you're preaching, you want to have the narrative read if possible before, but some narratives are very long, and you might decide in the service to divide it up into two or three different sections to have it read. But you shouldn't assume that because it's been read, everybody knows the story. You do also have to keep referring to the story and taking people through the story as it becomes the subject of your sermon. And lastly, the narrator's comment. That's an important ingredient in the whole narrative, because the narrator is our guide, he's our interpreter, he's the one whom God has inspired to write it down. He's often inconspicuous, we hardly realise he's there, but his evaluation determines the direction of the narrative and the thrust of the passage. And the perspective that the narrator has dictates the way in which we're to look at it. We were in Exodus chapter 2 a little while ago, and there's a classic case of that at the end of Exodus 2, where after Moses is born, taken into Pharaoh's household, the abortive attempt to free the Israelites by killing the slave driver and his fleeing to Midian, and his marriage to Jethro's daughter, and so on, all of that accomplished in, what, 22 verses. Then the last three verses of Exodus 2 say this: during that long period the king of Egypt died, the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, so God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Now, you wouldn't know that from the narrative text. The narrative text looks as though he isn't concerned at all, as though Moses, yes, he's been rescued, but he isn't now rescuing his people, and he's out in the desert shepherding the sheep of his father-in-law. How is this God's answer? And the narrator comes in, and I think the narrator is probably Moses. They are the books of Moses. There's every reason why he should have written this. And he says, yes, but what we've got to remember is that during that long period, the 80 years, when it looked as though all their cries were not being answered, God was actually behind the scenes putting it all together. And he heard their groaning. He remembered his covenant. He looked on the Israelites. He was concerned. Four verbs about God, which can be a huge encouragement when it looks as though your prayers are not being answered. The narrator's comment enlightens the whole chapter. And that's often the way in which it works. So always take that seriously. Go for the narrator's comments. They are the key to understanding the significance. Well, now, much better to work on an example. So I thought we'd take as an example 1 Samuel chapter 7, verses 2 to 13, and for the last part of our time together this afternoon, we'll start to launch out into that. So we're going to preach as the visiting preacher at St. Murgatroyd's in the Marsh, and it's 1 Samuel 7 that we're asked to preach on, here we are. We've got it given to us, and we need to think about what we're going to do with this passage. It's best to work chronologically through the text, first of all, bearing those analytical questions in mind that we've just looked at all the time, and to try and work through a significant approach to it. So let's read it first so that we've all got it in our minds, and then we'll do a little bit of work in small groups, and we'll feedback together in the larger group after that. To remind ourselves of context, pretty gloomy context. Things have been going pretty badly. You remember how Samuel is the one bright light, really, the one who is raised up by God, who's been in touch with God since his childhood, called by God to be the judge of Israel. But how the priesthood was completely corrupt, the sons of Eli and so on. The Philistines have captured the ark. And although the ark's been restored to Israel, it's not at the heart of Israel. So spiritually, things are at a really low ebb when you come to 1 Samuel 7. And after 1 Samuel 7, they ask for a king. The big, big thing on the agenda of chapter 8 is, give us a king like all the other nations. So spiritually, not good. And then we get this story right in the middle of it. It was a long time, 20 years in all, this is 7:2, that the ark remained at Kiriath Jearim, and all the people of Israel mourned and sought after the Lord. And Samuel said to the whole house of Israel, if you're returning to the Lord with all your hearts, then rid yourselves of the foreign gods and the Ashtoreths, and commit yourselves to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. So the Israelites put away their Baals and Ashtoreths and served the Lord only. That in itself is an extraordinary verse in this context. Then Samuel said, assemble all Israel at Mizpah, and I will intercede with the Lord for you. When they had assembled at Mizpah, they drew water and poured it out before the Lord. On that day they fasted, and there they confessed, we have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel was judge or leader of Israel at Mizpah. When the Philistines heard that Israel had assembled at Mizpah, the rulers of the Philistines came up to attack them. And when the Israelites heard of it, they were afraid because of the Philistines. They said to Samuel, do not stop crying out to the Lord our God for us, that he may rescue us from the hand of the Philistines. Then Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it up as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. He cried out to the Lord on Israel's behalf, and the Lord answered him. While Samuel was sacrificing the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to engage Israel in battle. But that day the Lord thundered with loud thunder against the Philistines and threw them into such a panic that they were routed before the Israelites. The men of Israel rushed out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines, slaughtering them along the way to a point below Bethkar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shechem. He named it Ebenezer, saying, "Thus far has the Lord helped us." So the Philistines were subdued and did not invade Israelite territory again. Throughout Samuel's lifetime, the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines. Well, we'll stop reading there. Verse 14 could equally, of course, be included in. It concludes there was peace between Israel and the Amorites. Very, very different situation at the end of the story from the situation at the beginning. Now, what we need to do really is to work out how the narrative progresses. So can I invite you to, in groups of threes and fours perhaps, not more than four, just to work together on what would you say are the major scenes in the story? How would you analyse the story in terms of its movement from scene to scene? And as we do that, perhaps we can also be thinking about how God is revealing himself in this situation. Really, what as you look at the scenes, be thinking too about what's the problem here that needs to be resolved and how does God intervene in the situation. But we may not have time for that. We may come back to that a little bit later. What I'd like to try and do, first of all, is to get the scene structures clear and for us to summarise what each picture really tells us in the story. So I think if we take sort of 10 to 15 minutes on that, that would be good, and then we'll get back together and combine what we've got. Okay? So do use the whole space and move the chairs around, and I'll call you back together in about 15 minutes.